So we're going to be in Ecclesiastes 5, and actually 5 and 6, blue, and Job 3 we're going to be looking at. So if you could be ready to read, or be ready to have those available and turn to them. I'm running a little behind this morning on everything. I didn't get my little bookmarks out for people to read Bible verses. But I do have a couple Bible verses I'd like to ask your volunteers. Thank you. So that's at the end of the handout. So you probably know this one by heart. Philippians 4:4 for Dave. And if I could get somebody over here to read John 10:10. Thank you, Gary in the back. And that should get us there. Okay. So this is a series in Ecclesiastes. This is actually the 19th lesson. We can take a 12-chapter book and turn it into a year-long study if we want to. That's all right. And last week we worked with chapter 5, the end of chapter 5. We're going to go back and we're going to review some of that and pick some of that back up in order to help us into chapter 6. Before I do that, we have a memory verse, and I've been sort of promising or threatening or something that I would give us an opportunity to do a recitation. So do I have any volunteers this morning to read or to recite Ecclesiastes 12, 13, 14? Any volunteers? Mike, thank you.
The end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of all mankind. For God will bring into judgment every deed along with every secret thing, whether good or evil.
All right, yes, very good. Yeah, you broke the ice, man. Thank you. Next week we'll ask for some more volunteers. Well, you have any more today? Okay, next week we'll ask for more volunteers, hopefully get a couple. And by the time we get done, the whole group should have this. It's only two verses. It's the last two verses of the book. And it's the punchline of the book. So, all right. The title of today's lesson is Better Off Having Been Aborted. I'm going to ask a very delicate question. Has anyone here ever been in a situation with somebody who was so depressed, so distraught, that they actually voiced those words? Has anybody actually heard those words in your ears? Okay, we have had one or two in the room, and I have. Horrible words to hear spoken. Certainly, by the way, does everybody have a handout? Anybody who doesn't have a handout? Let me just, because I've got a few extras up here. Wonderful. Horrible words to be spoken in the first person, but spoken millions of times in the second person, or you could say the third person, in the sense that the abortion industry reflects the conclusion that a child, because it is a decision about the future of a preborn human being, a decision that the child would be better off, or at least the mother would be better off, and therefore the child would be better off if they were aborted. This is not a new idea. It's right here in the book of Ecclesiastes, where Koheleth says a stillborn child is better off, and that's not the only place in the Bible where it says that. Job 3, and we're going to turn to that in a minute, so if you can want to flip to it, but Job 3 is an entire chapter of the book on that very topic. And so this is a very serious notion of being so depressed, so distraught, so down that you would arrive at the conclusion that you're better off if you had never been born. I don't ever quote from anonymous blogs, except for today. I have one. This one, I read it and I... there was a certain genuineness about it. Let me read it and see if you agree. It's a post actually, it's not necessarily anonymous. I just didn't stalk the person to find out who they really were. But it says, seriously, if you are to believe Christians who say that all babies go to heaven, then I would have been better off never having been born. As it is now, I am unable to believe in God, even though I'd like to. And because of this, I will supposedly burn in hell forever. Which is the better option? Getting aborted in the fetal stage, where I won't remember anything anyway, and going straight to heaven for eternity, or living out my life out for 70 to 80 years and then spending eternity in hell? What's a measly 70 to 80 years compared to eternity? I don't remember anything before I was born anyway. Now, there's a very confused person writing this here. But they're doing two things. One thing they're saying, you know, there's a certain logic to that. It's really the same logic in some sense that Job brings, is that, you know, you go through all the difficulties of life, and in Job's case, the difficulties were multiplied. You go through all the difficulties of life and then you die. And it's not illogical to ask, well, if we're talking about heaven and preborn children go to heaven, maybe I'd have been better off not having to prove what a sinner I am effectively, and going to hell, but just having gone to heaven. Very confusing, very bad stuff. But yet it's language that does come around and visit us sometimes. Anytime somebody commits suicide, in a sense, they're rendering a judgment on their life, and they're basically saying, I'm just better off dead. And whether that's saying, I'm better off dead because of what's happened in the last 5 minutes or 5 hours or 5 days or 5 weeks or 5 months or 5 years, or I've taken stock of my whole life and I'm better off dead. And I say, I bring this up, you know, in the wake of Javon Belcher, who just a couple days ago, an NFL football player, killing his girlfriend and himself. Bad stuff can lead to suicides. If you look at risk factors, typical risk factors, a previous suicide attempt is the number one risk factor for suicide. But problems with school, problems with the law, breakup of a romance, unexpected pregnancy, stressful family life, loss of security, including safety, a sense of security, but safety, people who live around gangs or other crime, stress due to new situations, failure of some kind, a job, school, serious illness or injury to oneself, seriously injuring someone else, causing someone else's death, or a major loss. A loved one, a home, a divorce, trauma, a relationship, those are all considered risk factors. The greatest risk factor for suicide, though, if you just look at the numbers, is being a high school student. You know what the second or third greatest risk factors are? Winning the lottery. Winning the lottery will get you more risk for committing suicide than if you hadn't won the lottery. Once you're out of high school, and we see the stories. I mean, here in Michigan, we had the Amanda Clayton just earlier this fall had won a $1 million lottery, and then does anybody remember what happened after that? Remember the story? Pardon me. Her friends came out of the woodwork, but what else happened? That's exactly right. That's exactly right. She's on television being interviewed and explaining why she thought it was okay to have food stamps. And she was found with an overdose and apparently a suicide just this fall. One of the more prominent suicides was a guy in Texas named Billy Bob Harrell, who was actually formerly a Pentecostal preacher. And he won $31 million in a Texas jackpot. And after lost everything. He lost his ranch. He lost his 6 homes. He lost his new cars. His wife divorced him. And within 2 years of winning the lottery, he committed suicide. So I thought I'd start you out today with a real cheerful, sort of uplifting... But bad stuff puts us at risk for suicide. Good stuff puts us at risk for suicide. How does that work? And there's actually a little tiny bit of a hint in that chapter 3 of Job. The whole chapter, he's lamenting his birth. The entire chapter. By the way, if someone is whining around about life and they're saying, you know, I don't know if I wish I was never born, say, no, don't give me that. See, you want to whine and say you wish you hadn't born, let's do it right. Turn to chapter 3 of Job. Let's get this down. Let me hear the real deal. You're a piker when it comes to complaining and wheedling and whining about life. So, chapter 3, and I'm just going to dive in on a couple of things. Of course, it starts out, let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived, let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom, and he's cursing the day he was conceived, and he was cursing the day he was born. And then verse 8, he says, let those cursed who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan, let the stars. He wants the whole universe to curse the day he was born. And then he describes the birthing process at verse 11 and 12. And he says that it should never have happened. But there's some interesting language in verse 17. There the wicked sees, he's talking about, why was I not hidden as a stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? Then verse 17, he says, there the wicked sees from troubling. Now he's not just talking about himself. He's gone philosophical on us. And he's generalized it. And he says, you know, this is not just me. Just not just me and the loss of my family and the loss of my wealth and the loss of my health. It's not just me. Look around you. The wicked are troubled. There are weary people in life. They're barely making it. They're barely crawling from one minute to the next, one hour to the next, one day to the next. You know, it's like, and verse 17, you can read it literally, but you can also read it figuratively. There are prisoners at ease together. There, in other words, in death, the prisoners are at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. Whether you're completely out of control of your life, you're a prisoner, your health is completely abandoned you, you're free, no matter where, you're free when you're dead. And if you're being oppressed, your oppressor is free at death. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. He goes through it logically, and he says, you know, we ought to just embrace threat. Look at what we've done with it. Now, please, I don't want to, say, well, we had a lesson, we should all go out and commit suicide. It says so in Job 3. It almost does seem to say that. As Job is expressing himself, he is just so distraught. In the last verse, I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest. And even as I can say I have no rest, what's the next phrase?
But trouble.
Here comes more trouble. And so when we read in Ecclesiastes that, which we'll get to Ecclesiastes in a minute, Ecclesiastes 5, we're going to be looking at 5 and 6, the end of 5, beginning of 6, we get to Ecclesiastes and we read, I'd have been better off stillborn. This is actually a thought process that is really should be part of the human experience. We should be thinking about this because there are people who, like this person that I read from the blog, who are not able to sort these things out. And when they can't sort these things out, no wonder there's suicide. So my question is, first of all, in item 4, if you met someone, and a few of us have, probably quite a few of us have, who are in such a distraught state of mind that really they're just about done. I mean, it's just, they're better off dead. And you would say, the question is, well, what would you say to them? Well, I'm going to break this down into two parts. part A is, let's assume you would bring the gospel to them. I'm hoping that's a safe assumption in this room. You would bring the gospel to them. But how would you do that? How would you articulate the gospel to that person who is in despair? I'm mindful of Joel that we talked about, and I'm mindful of Hilda, and I'm mindful of a lot of folks in our lives that really are up against it. How would you articulate the gospel to that person who is not even sure life is worth living? Yeah. Okay. All right.
He was possessed with despair that he was praying. God didn't want that to happen. He on the cross, he said, "My God, why did you forsake me?"
That's right.
Christ has experienced those things.
Excellent. Excellent.
Not alone.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. Anyone else? I know it's kind of hard to top that one, right? But anyone else? Yeah.
I think it would be beneficial to speak about a sin-cursed world,
okay,
and the effects of sin.
The topic that we were talking about on campus this week at Ratio Christi was the problem of evil. And the question of, and this is, there are several different reasons why anyone would ask about the problem of evil. An atheist would ask about the problem of evil because the atheist would propose that evil, ergo no God. Because there is evil, there cannot be a God. It's impossible for there to be a God, at least a God that we think of in terms of all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-loving. If God was all that loving and all that powerful that could prevent the evil and knows about the evil, then it's not logical, it doesn't follow logically that God could exist if we have evil. Just real quickly, the answer to that is there's absolutely no reason why. There's a logical incompatibility to that. There's absolutely
right.
No reason why.
Yeah.
Okay. But then you have agnostics, or people who would think, well, there's probably a God, and I don't know, and if there's evil, then how could there be a God? And the answer is that, well, now you're asking about probabilities, you're looking at evidence, and you're drawing conclusions from evidence. And while you might, I'll grant that it's difficult to understand, unless you really have a clear understanding of God, and you're just kind of on the edge of an understanding of God, it's difficult to have an understanding of God plus evil as a factor. But don't look at it by its own factor. It's only one factor that tells you about God. You have all of the rest of general revelation. You have creation, you have design, you have fine-tuning. You have the origin, the beginning of everything. Plus you have the resurrection, the factual history of the resurrection, the reality of Jesus Christ, birth, death, life, death, and resurrection. And you have the prophecies of the Bible. There's so many things, the awesomeness of the universe, large and small, universe in terms of the universe at large, and small in terms of genetics and molecular design and everything else. And so, yeah, you might have some trouble with that in terms of helping inform you about God, but lay it aside all the other evidence. And so I just gave you a real quick Cliff Notes version of how to discuss that. But we live in a sin-cursed world, and an understanding of God is an understanding of God's holiness.
Amen.
And his perfection and his moral purity. And one of the most difficult things to talk about evil is that people lock on to exaggerations of evil. And that's kind of, I guess, human nature, literally, in the sense that somehow or another, even Adam and Eve somehow concluded that disobeying the one itty-bitty little law that they were given from the lawgiver in the garden was kind of okay. And we've done that ever since in the human race. We rank evil. And what we like to do is we say, well, we got really, you have genocide. Let's put that at the genocide. Put that at the top, okay? And then, you know, maybe telling a white lie is down here somewhere. Or some other small, stealing a pencil from work. You know, something really small. We'll put that down here, okay? And then we'll figure out where to draw the line. Where does God draw the line? What, at you? No, well, God, right. I mean, God's standard is that, which means to say even the tiniest impurity, as it says in Proverbs, a fly in the ointment.
And you still have to use that language to say the tiniest.
The tiniest, and that doesn't even get us there.
That's right.
It doesn't get there.
That's our language.
It's like the, it's right. You slice it in half, it's smaller than that. You slice it in half, it's smaller. You can't get there to get to the purity of God. And so that's it. Okay, any other suggestions on how you would begin your discussion of the gospel with somebody in the dire straits? Please, Dan.
I don't know if I was going through some at one time in my life, and a person said to me, and I don't know what the validity of this, but they said that, you know, God is not as concerned about your happiness on earth as the fact that you're following him.
God versus my happiness. That is absolutely true. Who says God's number one duty is my happiness? Where did it? Who came up with that? Where is that ever written?
Genesis. Yeah, Oral Roberts.
You know, what's God's number one concern?
His glory.
His glory.
Amen.
His glory. Worship of him. Acknowledgement of him for who he is. That's his glory is his concern, not my happiness. So thank you. That's exactly right. Good. Anyone else? Please.
We have a hope in Christ, and it's not based
on the circumstances that we find ourselves in. Our hope, our expectation, our confidence, our future. Everything that we have in front of us, not in the rearview mirror, but everything we have in the front of us is in God's control. In the rearview mirror, it's history. But in the front of me is in God's control, and that's where that hope is. Thank you. Anyone else? Please.
It would depend on their emotional state, I think, at that point. But since I'm a little less compassionate than some people who think, it's probably, I would probably end up at some point if you are right, then what you're saying is completely logical and correct.
Okay.
If it's true that there is no God and there is no hope, and you know, then yeah, maybe you would be better off. There's logic to that. However, I think that sometimes people try to make people feel better and kind of think, oh, that's not true. It would be true.
It really is absolutely true. In fact. Oh, I love it when I get to do the introduction and then skip to the end and not actually do the lesson. at the end of the lesson, the punchline of today's lesson was supposed to be, part of it, Matthew 6:24, no one can serve two masters, for he will hate the one and love the other, or will he be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God in money, or as it says in the King James, mammon, or as it really means in a full understanding of the Greek, the world. You cannot serve God in the world. So if all you've got is the world, maybe you got something there. If you can honestly say there is no God and I am just goo that God showed up here by way of the zoo, maybe you've got something here. What's the point? And really, I'd consider at that point reading Job 3 to him. Say, let me describe it the real way and read Job 3 to him. But we also read in Ecclesiastes that God puts eternity in the heart. And very seldom can people really say, one of the great philosophers in the last century, his name was Jacques Derrida. And Jacques Derrida is a grew up Jewish, but became an atheist. But he never called himself an atheist because he said, I hold myself out as an atheist. What did he mean by that? What he meant by that is, I can imagine God. I can look around me and I can see creation. I can see beauty. I can see awesomeness. And I can imagine God. And I can't get that out of my mind. And because I can imagine God, even though I don't believe that I believe that there is a God, I can imagine God. And I cannot remove that. So I can't really say I'm an atheist. I can say I hold myself out as an atheist. But I can't reach in and grab that eternity in my heart. I'm now paraphrasing Jacques Derrida, forgive me. I can't reach in and grab the eternity in my heart and rip it out. It's still there. And so, Amanda, I think you're absolutely right. I think that sometimes there's an old Eastern European proverb. I should never give proverbs unless they come from the Bible, but Eastern European proverb is, somebody is laying face down in the mud, don't help them up. Anybody know the proverb? What are you supposed to do? Step on their head. That's Eastern European, okay? You got. Why would you step on their head? No, that's not why. Just the opposite.
So you don't get your foot dirty.
No, that's not why either.
Show them.
If you're face down in the mud and somebody steps on your head, what's your reaction going to be? You're going to get up. You're going to get up. Sometimes we have to push people into the mud. And that's sometimes what we have here. Okay, now don't take, that was not a biblical lesson. That was not a biblical lesson. And I'm not sure I'm a WWJD. What would Jesus do? Just not know. All right. But let me walk us through a couple points, the rest of the lesson. And what I want to do real quickly, I'm going to skip number 6. You can just look at that on your own. It's basically a psychologist's summary of people's real needs. They think that their need is that, you know, they need money or they need health or they would. But that's a more thorough articulation of what people really need. And it maps actually fairly closely to some other things in Ecclesiastes. Come up for air that we'll be doing. Ecclesiastes 5, if you have it open. Ecclesiastes 5. Let me just show you a couple things about it. First of all, if you'll notice in my handout, at 7a, I have 5, 8 to 12, 6, 7 to 9. 5, 8 to 12, 6, 7 to 9 say very similar things. They speak to, if you look at, where's my Bible verses? Okay, separate pages. The faster I try to hurry, the worse it gets. So, okay. Yeah, would you read chapter? Would you read read 5?
8 to 12.
Yeah, please.
If you see in province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at that matter, for the high officials watch by higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivating fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This is also vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them, and what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep.
Thank you. And so just drawing out of there, we see corruption and oppression.